You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world. You are calling me back.
I mean, I can't think of anything. Can you?
No, nothing. About a walking desk. It hasn't come yet. That's all I can think.
Oh, it hasn't come yet?
Oh, I think it might be outside, but...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Walking desk. Maybe we could walk and podcast.
I was just thinking that. I was like, I don't think I could podcast while walking.
I saw a funny meme today. It said, 1,000% tariff on podcast equipment.
Wait, why is that funny? Other than it's just kind of funny.
Because, everybody's arguing about tariffs right now. Like,
yeah, and I mean, it's like those podcasters, like, they're trying to shut down.
Yeah, like, podcasts. The caption was, like, outlaw podcasts.
Yeah, yeah.
And just because everybody has a podcast, and, it's all, like...
Well, don't they think the election was, like, won by podcasting,
kind of? I don't think that's what this particular meme is about, but yes. Yeah, you're thinking of when I said to you, somebody said the election was... X and podcasts versus legacy media.
Yes, that's right.
That's what you're thinking.
That's right.
But I think the meme was more like referencing how everybody has a podcast now. Is that mic pointed right at your
No,
mouth?
It's not. I need to scoot it a little bit.
Hey, do it.
Okay, there we go. No, I was literally just thinking, to be honest, because I do have like one podcast I don't do anymore and one I want to do. I was literally thinking maybe on that one I haven't done yet, maybe I could walk during that one.
Yeah, the thing is you're gonna
but then I was like, then I feel it.
Yeah, you're gonna huff and puff and you're gonna be like, yeah, I'll, because it's
yeah,
not just,
I guess you're right.
I mean, you're walking, but I think you're supposed to kind of like break a sweat and
yeah,
get a little cardio,
point.
You know?
Okay, yes.
I don't know if being on camera for that is like a great idea.
Yeah, that's true.
But I've always been about multitasking and like I'm super excited by the idea of getting exercise while doing some of life's.
I know you've mentioned it before. Why did it take you so long to get one? Is this the first Black Friday purchase you've ever made?
Absolutely.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Why did it take me so long? I mean, I don't know. I have no idea. I mean, I have a particular meeting once a week that I really don't like just sitting there for. It bugs me.
Yeah,
because it feels really static and I could totally be walking. So I think with that meeting becoming very regular, I was like, I've got to do something. And the person I'm meeting with doesn't like it when I'm on the elliptical.
He said that.
Yeah. And it is a little hard to like take notes, which I have to do on the elliptical. But with the treadmill. The walking desk, whatever you call it.
Yeah.
That will be possible. So, yeah, that's exciting.
That is exciting. You'll have to report back.
Okay, that was small talk. And close.
I'll be impressed if somehow that
this
links.
Is Small Talk, the podcast. What'd you say?
I'll be impressed if somehow there's any link.
Exactly. Heidegger's going to actually post his review of his walking desk in this section. Actually, you told me something.
Oh my God. Yeah. I was just thinking that.
What was it?
So we were, I can't remember. Oh, we were looking for the lecture on art. It ended up on his Wikipedia page and we learned that apparently like he was unfaithful to his wife and she was unfaithful to him. And like she slept with like, I don't know, someone in their circle and got pregnant and he raised the kid as if it was his kid, but everyone knew, or I don't, yeah, I think they told the kid even at like 12 or something, but I thought that was really sweet.
Mm.
And then he was having some long, like writing letter thing with his wife's friend. So either they were like just super advanced and kind of semi-open marriage, or they were, I don't know. I mean, you would think if he's like writing to his wife's friend that she would probably know that that was happening, the wife.
You would think so, yeah. And then he had a big affair with Hannah Arendt, right?
Yeah. I didn't read anything
about that. But he was like married to his wife his whole life.
I think so.
I don't know. I think it's just like a tradition or a custom or a national vibe that we don't quite understand, you know?
Well, oh yeah, and then the first sentence was like...
there probably wasn't divorce back then. No, I mean, in a lot of ways, you know?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, but it sounds like it just started right away. It's just kind of like, I don't know, but maybe it's just a thing. Which is funny because you think of it as being so like traditional, but maybe it was actually really...
I mean, there's a little bit of like the free love thing.
Yeah.
Going on then, which I don't know. You call that advanced. I don't know if that's advanced.
It also said like it brought up Nazism in like literally the first sentence. And I also listened to some podcast about some guy who was like exposing Wikipedia as like a very liberally edited space, which I'd never really occurred to me. But when I read that about, when I read him and his Nazi affiliation, like the first sentence of what he's about, that made me think of that accusation to Wikipedia. Cause I was like, oh, Wikipedia, it's like a, you know, encyclopedia, but like it has a slant as well.
Yeah,
and then, sorry, one more thing to say. And then also, so then they also brought up.
I want to address the slant though.
Okay.
I think that's, my guess is that a larger majority of people inclined to go editing a lot of Wikipedia pages are of a liberal persuasion politically.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be my guess.
Yes. So you're saying it makes sense.
It's not that like Wikipedia is fomenting a slant of that kind from top down.
I agree.
Just probably due to
the editors.
The type of people who end up being Wikipedians. Right. That would be my guess.
Yeah, I agree.
Which is maybe my, I don't know, maybe that's my bias or something, or prejudice or whatever you phrase it. So what are you going to say?
Well, and then they also made a point of it being like both the women who he, like Hannah Arendt and this woman he was writing to, I think were both Jewish. Like, so like there was a big point about, or maybe his, I don't know, two of
them. So he was a Nazi, he was hot for Jews.
Yeah.
Now that's advanced. Okay.
It's complicated.
That does sound like a complicated world.
Yeah.
All right. So we're, speaking of complicated worlds, we're on section 33.
Page 58.
58. That's right. Of Contributions to Philosophy of the Event by Heidegger. So we're going to read section 33 tonight. Maybe more, but we'll see, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And just a reminder that when we say bang, we're pronouncing the word B-E-Y-N-G, which is an alternative spelling of B-E-I-N-G. And the book is kind of an exploration of what that alternative spelling signifies. What?
I was just going to say, it's sort of dramatic calling it bang.
Yeah, I know. It's just, I doubt, like I said, I don't think we're probably the only people who pronounce it that way.
Yeah.
And in case, I'll just remind people that that's because I first listened to the book on my bike in New York City. And there's no Audible version of this book. So I used a text-to-speech program, and the robot woman pronounced B-E-Y-N-G, bang. But the only other way I've heard it pronounced is being, which, you know, makes no sense.
Yeah.
And buying seems weird.
Yeah, that doesn't quite work either.
Boing. You could say boing.
Boing. That's kind of cool.
Boing. Buying.
We could try boing.
Buying. I don't know. Bang is cool. Like B E Y.
Yeah.
I was, you know, on the face of it, really could be bay.
Yeah.
Like hey, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Or way, W-H-E-Y. So.
But it always makes me think of bang as in B A N G.
Yes, like, yeah, exactly.
Which is like not. I don't know. But maybe
it's
cool.
It's a
conundrum. We'll solve it by the end.
I agree. I'm not crazy about bang. It's just because it's such a bang word, but it's, I think it's all we're left with. And yeah, we're so far along that I think it would be weird if we changed it now.
Sure, sure.
Okay. So section 33, the question of bang.
33, the question of bang. As long as we do not recognize that all calculation in terms of, quote, purposes and, quote, values arises from a quite determinate interpretation of beings as, Greek word, looks like idea. What does it mean?
Yeah, idea. It means form or pattern. So quite from a determination, interpretation of beings as form.
Hmm. Okay. As long as we do not grasp that the question of being is not even surmised thereby, let alone asked, as long as we finally do not testify by carrying it out that we know of the necessity of this unasked question and accordingly are already asking it, as long as all this remains outside the horizon of that which still deports itself like, quote, philosophy, that is how long all vociferous fussing over, quote, bang, quote, ontology, quote, transcendence, and, quote, paratranscendence, quote, metaphysics, and the supposed overcoming of Christianity is groundless and empty. One is still unwittingly moving in the ruts of the same neo-Kantianism, and that is so often reviled. For nowhere is thoughtful work accomplished, not a single step of a revelatory questioning is carried out.
So, yeah, so this is a long sentence.
Yeah.
But what he's saying is there are some things that if we're not going to do them, then our philosophy is going to be useless,
mm-hmm,
or what he calls groundless and empty. And the things, here are the things that we need to do. So I'm going to kind of invert the negatives to turn them into, mm-hmm, positives. We need to recognize that all calculation in terms of purposes and values arises from a quite determinate interpretation of beings as idea. So if we're gonna make calculations about purpose, what things are for, what their goal is, where they're headed, what their internal teleology is, and if we're going to make calculations about values, meaning what is valuable, what we value, has worth, what is important, we need to recognize that any calculation in terms of these things comes from us interpreting beings as ideas,
hmm,
from an ideological or ideational view of the world. The world obviously is a lot of things other than ideas, but when we interpret beings as ideas, that's what gives us the ability to calculate things in terms of purposes and values. We need to grasp that the question of bang is not even we need to understand that the question of bang is not even surmised thereby, let alone asked. So meaning, mm-hmm, if we're gonna calculate purposes and values through an interpretation of beings as idea, the question of bang isn't gonna even be asked.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to testify by carrying out that question that we know of the necessity of this unasked question. We need to recognize the necessity of this unasked question. And in a sense are already asking it. If we don't do any of these things, then whatever calls itself philosophy or whatever carries itself in a philosophical way or pretends to be carrying out philosophy and sits there and loudly fusses over things like ontology and transcendence and metaphysics and the supposed overcoming of Christianity, meaning kind of, again, the death of God, the new order, the post-religious scientism is going to be groundless and empty. None of it's going to be worth anything. One is still unwittingly moving in the ruts of the same neo-Kantianism that is so often involved. So still, we're just going to be peddling our wheels. Spinning our wheels in a neo-Kantianism that is so often reviled, meaning a neo-Kantianism is obviously post-Kantian philosophy that again is grounded in an interpretation of beings as idea. For nowhere is thoughtful work accomplished, not a single step of revelatory questioning is carried out unless we do those things. That's it.
Yeah, that's cool. It does feel really hard to find revelatory questions or revelatory things. I don't know.
It's hard to find revelatory revelatory questions.
Yeah.
What you said?
Yeah.
Sure.
Or revelatory statements or outside of Heidegger, anyways.
Yeah.
Like on social media or something.
Yeah.
It's just like, the quotes are abundant.
Yeah. You mean the neo-Kantian social media?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even when it's like, I don't know.
Well, it's interesting. I made a post the other day. I thought that there were three reasons. And again, this is just me trying to get likes, but there are three reasons that the rise of the internet meant the rise of identity. Do you want to hear them?
Yeah.
It kind of relates to what you're saying. First off, the internet is an electronic, a mesh of electronic information, which relies on ones and zeros. Every packet of information is a conglomeration of ones and zeros. And if one is not one and zero is not zero, then there is no information. So there's a stricture, there's a identitarian demand inherent in being on the computer. And I think that really infects us. Mm. Secondly, I think you can only be on the internet with your identity. And I don't mean that, you have to like show your ID and be exactly who you are, but that I think the parts of you are what is you outside your identity, can't really make its way onto the internet or into social media because I think it's outside. It gets kind of squeezed out when it gets funneled into that electronic format.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I think the internet is a series of a menagerie of profiles seeking supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
Each profile is seeking supremacy,
mm-hmm.
and it's a power game, mm-hmm. and that profiles seeking supremacy is actually just an analogy for identities.
Mm-hmm.
That's what identities are. They are profiles seeking supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you said your social media feed. I mean, I would agree with you that because of the format, because of the medium, there's a lot of interpretation of beings as ideas.
Mm-hmm.
If social media is your only alternative to Heidegger, you're probably gonna be confused.
Well, and also, it's like the phrase the attention economy, right? Or clicks or something. Just that, like, I think you're very right. The profile seeking supremacy is like what the internet's about. It's like competing profiles. So in order to get that attention, you have to say things that are dramatic. Or I mean, you don't have to, but I guess most people do. So like dramatic or incendiary or I don't know, like concerning. I don't know. Like what are the right words? Like the just really.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
We need to be concerned about this, mm-hmm. To make people feel guilty if they don't look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's like a lot of like flashing neon lights saying mm-hmm. over here,
mm-hmm.
care mm-hmm. about this, worry about this, buy this.
Yes.
Like it's really hard to find places online for me anyways that are like calm or thoughtful or intricate or
see,
subtle.
I would say, I mean, I think you spend all your time on algorithmic.
That's true, yes.
Social media feeds?
Well, aren't all social media
I mean, feeds I'm not sure. You, I'm not sure YouTube is algorithm. I mean, there's a certain algorithm in YouTube, yeah. But YouTube is a little more just search driven.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I mean, YouTube is still an environment in which you're trying to get likes.
Yeah.
And, I don't know, the mystery of getting likes and how to get likes and the kind of stuff that gets likes, that's a whole different thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think you're right. I mean, the inflammatory, the exaggerated, the...
The beings as idea.
Yeah, I mean...
I mean, purpose, values, that's...
Yeah, it's an interesting topic. It's an interesting thing. I don't know if I have much to say about it right now, but
yeah.
But I think that's to try to describe the kind of thing in a Heideggerian sense that seems to thrive on the internet would be an interesting project.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna think about that. Maybe we get back to it. Let's keep reading.
Yeah. I mean, aren't they necessarily beings abandoned by being because they're digital?
I mean, yeah, in a way. Yeah. Certainly. I mean, there's definitely... I mean, a disembodied discourse like that is a whole different ballgame.
Yeah.
Than sitting in a room with people or standing in the street.
And kind of like coming to terms with how... You're kind of there, but you're kind of not there at the same time. Yeah. That's the thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's one big show.
Yeah.
I mean, in the sense that like you're put in, you know, you're like put into the audience position, even if you're mm-hmm. commenting or shouting or liking or whatever you're doing. So there's a lot of talking at.
Mm-hmm.
And there's obviously like a power dynamic. There's the stars and there's the watchers,
mm-hmm.
or shall we say the influencers and the followers. So yeah,
mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah, let's keep going.
I've been on my phone all day, so I'd rather go back to Heidegger. Go ahead.
Precisely the one who has grasped the question of being and has actually at one time tried to traverse its course. Can hope to receive nothing more from, quote, antiquity and from its lineage except for the frightful admonition to transfer questioning back again to the same ground of necessity, not of that initial definitively past necessity, which only thus occurs essentially. Instead, quote, repetition here means to let the same... The uniqueness of being become a plight again and thereby out of a more original truth. Quote, again means here precisely, quote, altogether otherwise, end quote. But that frightful admonition still lacks a hearing and a willingness to sacrifice. To stay on the scarcely opened up next stretch of the course.
Whoever has grasped the question of being and has actually at one time tried to traverse its course will receive nothing from antiquity and its lineage other than the frightful admonition to transfer questioning back again to the same ground of necessity.
What does that mean?
Not of that initial definitively past necessity which only thus occurs essentially. not that initial definitively past necessity. Well, so if you have grasped the question of being and tried to traverse its course, then antiquity and its lineage, so basically like all ancient thinking, all ancient philosophy, all mm-hmm. ancient metaphysics,
all first beginning,
yes, is only going to basically frightfully admonish you, meaning like it's going to just, mm-hmm. it's going to, your experience with antiquity is going to be like, it's, you're going to kind of, it's going to only basically compel you to do something. And it's going to compel you to take that question of being and thrust it back on antiquity.
Mm.
Okay. And ask those questions of antiquity that kind of undercut the necessity of antiquity as a definitively past necessity, which occurs essentially.
Mm-hmm.
See, so in a way he's just saying, if you've gone through the question of being and you're on that course, really all antiquity has to offer you is the compulsion and the advice that you should question its necessity.
Mm.
Basically.
Mm-hmm.
And he says repetition here means to let the same, the uniqueness of bang, become a plight again and thereby out of a more original truth. So to repeat antiquity and to repeat its lineage for this kind of person means you need to let the uniqueness of bang become a plight again out of a more original truth. And to become a plight again, he means to become a plight in an altogether different way.
mm-hmm.
But that frightful admonition that antiquity thrusts on the thinker still lacks a hearing and a willingness to sacrifice to stay on the scarcely opened up next stretch of the course. So even if that frightful admonition occurs, that doesn't mean it will be heard, and that that doesn't mean it will generate a willingness to sacrifice and to stay on the scarcely opened up next stretch of the course, to continue in the task.
Hmm.
He says, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Instead, one deludes oneself and others, evading one's own perplexity by means of a noisy fanaticism for the, quote, antiquity suffered by Nietzsche. How far removed from such goings on are, for example, the figure and work of Hermann Lotz, the most genuine witness to the easily reviled and much reviled 19th century.
Yeah, those are some obscure philosophical references.
Mm-hmm.
I think we can just leave them alone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think he's just basically saying, like, you know, the shallow avoidances of perplexity by blabbing about the kind of antiquity that Nietzsche talked mm-hmm. about, you know, basically getting your antiquity through Nietzsche is shallow.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have to read a lot of Nietzsche to understand what that means. I don't think it's that important. And how far removed from such goings on are, for example, the figure and work of Hermann Lotze, who I don't even know who he is. So,
mm-hmm.
so let's keep going.
Should we keep going?
Yeah.
34, the event and the question of being. The event is the self-eliciting and self-mediating center in which all essential occurrence of the truth of being must be thought back in advance. This thinking back in advance to that center is the inventive thinking of Bang, and all concepts of Bang must be uttered from there.
Yeah, so it's weird, right? Like, he's got like the event and the question of being.
Mm-hmm, I know.
But then he's got the question of Bang. I'm not always quite sure what the difference, what the differences are. I mean, in a sense, the question of being and the question of Bang are very related things. One leads to the other, one necessitates the other, but we should watch out for what the differences are. The event, and this book is called Of the Event, in part, so the event is very important, Aragnus. The event is the self-eliciting and self-mediating center. So the event is the central spot in which all essential occurrence of the truth of Bang must be thought back in advance. So we must always return to the event as the place where the truth of Bang occurs. And this thinking back to that center is the inventive thinking of Bang. And all concepts of Bang must be uttered from there. So, important. Go back to the event. Back to the event when you're thinking about Bang and considering the truth of Bang. Go ahead.
Conversely, everything which, at first, and in the plight, and merely in the transition from the developed guiding question to the basic question, is thought about Bang and is interrogated as a way to the truth of Bang, the unfolding of Dasein, must never be translated into the groundless wasteland of any previous, quote, ontology or, quote, doctrine of categories, end quote.
Yeah, so, you know, if we're going to think about Bang and we're going to consider the truth of Bang and interrogate Bang, we need to be sure that we're not just... we're not just kind of throwing an established ontology or a doctrine of categories at it. We need to be sure and look at it uniquely, originally, mm-hmm. and newly. Yeah.
The tacit presentiment of the event offers itself prominently and at once in historical recollection.
Means the Greek means being equals presence.
Right. Being equals presence as, quote, primordial temporality, end quote. The occurrence of the having been pre-serving and futural anticipating transporting, i.e. the occurrence of the opening and the grounding of the quote there and thus of the essence of truth.
The tacit presentiment of the event offers itself prominently and at once in historical recollection as primordial temporality. So the sort of the tacit feeling or understanding we have about the event is offered to us in historical recollection as a kind of primordial temporality. So the series of events that compose historical recollection form a primordial temporality that we can relate to, which I think in a way... what you could say is historical recollection is about remembering what happened. But of course, we do a lot more than that when we recollect historically now. We interpret what happened. Mm-hmm. We ascribe laws and rules and purposes and values and reasons to what happened. But what he's saying is, there's a primordial temporality in historical recollection, which is simply the series of events that make up that history. Mm-hmm. The occurrence of the having been preserving and futural anticipating transporting. So this is an extension of that sentence. this primordial temporality is the occurrence of the having been and the futural anticipating transporting. Those are aspects of this primordial temporality. The primordial temporality contains or is a set of occurrences of two things: the occurrence of what was or the having been, and the occurrence of the futural or the anticipating, meaning in the composition of primordial temporality, there are things that simply were, and there are things that seem to be transporting or creating a futural anticipatory energy towards what will become. I.e., this is the basically what he's saying is, in this primordial temporality, there is the occurrence of the opening and grounding of the there, what is there, and thus of the essence of truth. Yeah. So I think I just want to say lastly on that, it's like, so much goes on in historical recollection. For instance, okay, maybe I'm going to say more than a little. There's a big article in The Atlantic this week, which I know your dad is going to send me at some point, by George Packer, who your dad just loves, who's a total idiot. I hope your dad never hears me say that. I'm just being brash, but George Packer is not a particularly smart individual, but and it's about the election. And in it, probably the third paragraph, he tells us why everyone voted for Trump. He has his explanation for that. That is not primordial temporality. That is not the event. That is not the occurrence and the of the opening and grounding of the there. That is calculations according to purposes and values. So there's a distinction how we look at history. The primordial temporality of the election is that this happened. That's it. Now, can you refrain? Can you restrain? Can you refuse to start thrusting ideas and purposes and values onto those events? Or can you not? And in a sense, that's kind of what we mean when we talk a little bit, when we talk about liberal in this podcast, is that liberalism has become the inability to refrain from that. Liberalism has become, at its core, an ideological take on history. And it can't simply step into the primordial temporality of the occurrence of events and let them be and start to look at their being and their there-ness and the essence of their of the truth that is their there-ness, because it's become ideological.
That's well said.
And I think that that bears some relevance to questions of anxiety, questions of selfhood, questions of consciousness, questions of how a person exists in the world, because you can exist in primordial temporality as a series of events, or you can exist in a calculating state of purposes, values, and ideas. And that goes back to how we talk about liberalism being at the heart of anxiety. Does that make sense?
Say more. Yeah.
Because if liberalism has become a compulsion to ideologize the primordial temporality of existence, then that becomes the conduit for the self. the self becomes an identity. It loses itself and becomes an identity in the ideological conduit of the liberal application of purposes, values, and ideas onto primordial temporality. Mm-hmm. So it, in a sense, gets manufactured, machinated, wrapped up in this process mm-hmm. of the ideation of time and the ideation of historical events. It can't yeah. see events anymore. It doesn't, the self loses its relationship to events and simply starts having relationships to ideas. Mm-hmm. And let's remember, ideas, mm-hmm. purposes, and values are profiles seeking supremacy. Mm-hmm. They are war. They are a disembodied discourse. Mm-hmm. They are ones that must be ones and zeros that must be zeros. They are electronic meshes of information that are controlled and controlling, and to involve oneself with them, to engage with them, to get wrapped up in that kind of, that neo-Kantian antiquity that has now become neoliberal contemporaneity. Contemporaneity is the right word. Mm-hmm. Is to hand yourself over to being abandoned by being, which is pure anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really well said.
It's all making sense, right?
Totally.
So Heidegger is admonishing us frightfully to return to the event, to look at the primordial temporality of the historical recollection, and to stay there, to stick there. Don't go beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now he goes on to...
we should talk. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Talk more about it. Quote, primordial temporality, end quote, is never meant as an improved version of the concept of time, as the usual substitution of, quote, lived time, end quote, Bergson-Dilthey, for the concept of calculable time. All of that remains outside the recognized necessity of the transition from the guiding question grasped as such to the basic question.
Yeah, he's saying, I'm not trying to say primordial temporality is some kind of better way to think of time in the way that, for instance, Bergson-Dilthey, mm-hmm. who were philosophers, talked about lived time mm-hmm. as being a improved version of the concept of time, mm-hmm. Better than, say, the concept of calculable time. Mm-hmm. All that stuff about improved versions of time is outside the recognized the need to make the transition from the guiding question, which is what antiquity has handed us, to the basic question, which is the question of Bang and the question of the truth of Bang.
In being and time, quote, time is a directive toward and a resonating with that which takes place in the uniqueness of the appropriation as the truth of the essential occurrence of Bang.
Okay, time is a directive toward and a resonating with what takes place in the uniqueness of the appropriation as the truth of the essential occurrence of Bang. So mm-hmm. this is a definition of time from Heidegger. Mm-hmm. So time is a directive toward, meaning it points us toward, it pushes us toward, and resonates with, so there's a relationship of energy and sound that time has with the uniqueness of the appropriation. And again, the appropriation is us being appropriated by Bang. Uniquely. And this, the appropriation as the truth of the essential occurrence. So the appropriation is the truth of the essential occurrence of Bang. So time directs us toward and resonates with our unique appropriation into the truth of the essential currents of Bang. So that's a very important definition of time. Mm-hmm. What is time? People have talked about this forever. Heidegger's giving a very, I would say, personal, experiential, event-based relatiocentric concept of time, that time kind of guides us to a, it's a guide to our appropriation into the essential currents of Bang. So time is not a series of numbers. Time is not a pattern. Time is not a calculation or a calculable measure. Time is not a past, present, and a future. It's not a series of numbers. It's not a, it's not the unfolding of tenses. It's not even, as I think Hegel calls it, the landscape of interiority. It is what is pushing us toward and resonating with our appropriation into the essential occurrence of Bang, or the event. Mm-hmm. To live and think in a way in which time is that. If you really study that sentence and understand how time is what he says right here, completely blows your mind.
Yeah.
Since,
so I mean, he's talking like now's a moment in time and it's this.
Yes.
Or it could be this if you take it like this. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the, if you seek a phenomenal perspective on what you feel and see and sense when you say the word time and how you have a relationship with time and what that relationship constitutes, if you kind of do that in your head and you ask yourself, what is my relationship to time? What is time to me? And don't just say, you know, it's not about like, it's 5 o'clock, or this is a moment in time, or yesterday was past time and now is present time and tomorrow will be. You're still just throwing a word around. Mm-hmm. What he's encouraging us to do is say, how do we actually encounter time? Mm-hmm. And how are we in time? And how does time happen to us and with us? And rather than time being a series of seconds and hours, which it very much is not, any more than the distance between here and that mountain up there is just a series of yards, right? Mm-hmm. That's just those are just measurements. It doesn't really have anything to do with what is between me and the mountain. Mm-hmm. And the same with time. Mm-hmm. So time is, space is an extension, time is an extension, or an intention, actually, as they often say. And so, you know, if you ask yourself what is your experience with time, then you'll discover that it according to Heidegger, it is very much a directive. It's a pointing toward, and a kind of, I don't know, I'm looking for a metaphor to resonating. I mean, a kind of sounding, I guess, is the only thing I think, or like a, like a birthing, that occurs when you are appropriated into the truth, the essential currents of Bang.
That's really, yeah.
I don't know what else to say. I mean, I can keep talking, but I think it's an important,
yeah.
And you know, meditate heavy on that, the way that, what that means, yeah, and how that actually, what that actually means for time and all the many things you think and feel and do, mm-hmm, with time as the architecture of those things, as the, mm-hmm, skeleton, as the framework.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Shall I keep going? I think he talks more about it a bit.
I think so. I think we're almost to the end of kind of like a little section. Yeah, yeah, go ahead.
It is only here in this original interpretation of time that the realm is encountered in which time and space reach the most extreme differentiation and thus precisely attain the most intimate essential occurrence. This relation is prepared in the presentation of the spatiality of Dasein, which is not the spatiality of the, quote, subject or the, quote, I. Cf. the grounding space.
Yeah, so only in this original interpretation of time, which he gave in that little paragraph there, do we really start to feel that time and space become intimate with, mm-hmm, each other, which we know they are, but it's, mm-hmm, hard to figure out how, because, mm-hmm, we think of time as this extended thing, past, present, future, calculated seconds, blah, blah, blah. And space is like left and right and east and west and up and down. How is space and time really the same thing? But people all talk about it. But he says, if we start to think of time in that way, we can start to see how they are kind of, we see their intimate essential occurrence. And he references the spatiality of Dasein, which is way different than the spatiality of the subject or the I. The spatiality of Dasein, mm-hmm, spatiality of Dasein is a timely spatiality. Mm-hmm. So go ahead.
The confusion and lack of discipline in contemporary, quote, thinking requires us to grasp its way almost catathetically, i.e. in the form of identified, quote, questions. To be sure, the will and style of decisive thought never reside in a more didactic meditation on these questions. Yet for the sake of clarity, especially over and against the idle talk of, quote, ontology and, quote, being, what must be known first is the following. Beings are, bang essentially occurs.
Yeah, so I think I agree with you. We should end there because that's kind of a section. Mm-hmm. The lack of discipline and confusion in contemporary thought, they require us to grasp its ways almost catechetically. Catechetics is religious training, in the form of identified questions.
That's interesting.
So the will and style of decisive thought never reside in a more didactic meditation on these questions. Yet for the sake of clarity, especially over and against the idle talk of ontology, what must be known first is the following. Beings are, bang essentially occurs. So this is the catechetics of his system. There need to be he's almost excusing himself. He's saying, you know, mm-hmm, I'm sorry to get didactic and, mm-hmm, with these questions and what's being said, but there's so much talk about ontology and being that we need to kind of start training ourselves to step out of the confusion and lack of discipline of contemporary thought and start to identify the important questions and what we really should be talking about. And the first two most important rules that he's going to set is that beings are, and bang essentially occurs. And we're gonna hear a lot more about that, I think, later, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hard to stop, but it's okay.
It is hard to stop, but I think we've been going for a little while, and I think it. It is hard to stop. But yeah, I don't know. Anything to say? I was thinking today about dying. Yeah. You know, my mother seems really surprised that her friend died. My mom's friend fell down the stairs and died. She's old. They're both old ladies. And she seems super surprised that that happened. And I think she seems really like, shocked that death is going to occur, which, you know, I'm sure a lot of people are in that situation as you get older, you know, and like you kind of ignore it and blah, blah, blah. But I was thinking like, I could feel today myself being like realizing that death was like near. I don't know. I was just kind of projecting into the future, thinking, oh, like death is near. I was thinking of sitting down in the driveway and just kind of like meditating a lot as death came. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking like, what would I be meditating on? And it was like, well, I think I would be, I don't know if I'd call it meditation, but I think I would be kind of like, I don't know, for lack of a better phrase, mind melding with the landscape. That's what I called it. Like, like I would be slowly spooning myself out of myself and putting myself into the dirt and coming to peace with that transition, not looking back and being like, oh, I'm going to miss this. I'm going to miss that. I'm going to miss this. Oh God, I can't believe I'm never going to exist again. I can't believe it was just a one shot, you know? But instead, in a sense, getting into time. That's what I'd put it. Getting into time. I would climb into time. I would climb into time as a directive and as a resonating, right, with my appropriation into the essential occurrence of the truth of being. Because that's what death is, the ultimate appropriation into the essential occurrence of the truth of being. Or it's not even ultimate. I would say it's just the last one in a series, right? So it's kind of your last, the last time. It's the big one. And so getting into time in that way, climbing into time as a kind of the way you would climb into a wagon or a car or climb onto a bike. It's such a, talk about a grand directive and a grand resonating. Your death is that. It's your final directive. It's the final resonating you will have. It's the final appropriation into the truth of being. But some of the essentials there is that, so what does that make being? What does that make the truth of being? What does that make the appropriation? How does that occur, not just in one's death, but in one's life constantly, reiteratively, repetitively throughout the day?
Yeah, as you don't want to just experience time only when you're dying.
Well, I don't. Yeah, you do. That's right. You do. That's right. You do. I don't think there's anything unique about experiencing time, but I guess I wanted to say, I think that because I can imagine that being a very immediate and powerful experience of time as a directive and a resonating with the essential currents of being, I think that in imagining that, you can actually start to get a sense for how that is occurring all the time with you. But you have to remember also, there are lots of ways that we go about trying to avoid climbing into time in that way.
Definitely.
Like, we don't want to climb into time because time is going somewhere. And I'm not talking about death. I'm talking about being appropriated by the essential occurrence of being. Like, we have a lot of ideas. We have a lot of purposes. We have a lot of values. We have a lot of calculations we need to make that keep us from being appropriated into time and taking time's directive and hearing time's resonating in the event in the primordial temporality that is all around us happening all the time. But we are so trained to ideate it that we spend a lot of time not climbing into time. Mm-hmm. I think that's what death does. Death finally says, you know, you can have lots of ideas mm-hmm. about this, mm-hmm. but actually, finally, you're facing something that you have no idea about mm-hmm. and you can't have any ideas about it. And the more ideas you have about it, the more you're just avoiding it. That's why I kind of brought up my mom. I think mm-hmm. my mom's had a lot of ideas about death. Mm-hmm. She quite famously is always talking about impermanence, impermanence, impermanence. Mm-hmm. And even she said herself, she's like, I'm always preaching impermanence, but I never really quite understood mm-hmm. what I was talking mm-hmm. about. I never had an immediate mm-hmm. experience with it. And now I am. Mm-hmm. So the ideas fizzle away. The purposes mm-hmm. and values and calculations fizzle away mm-hmm. in the face of death. And so I think that's why I was imagining that. But I think in that is a template for all kinds of climbings into time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're climbing into time, you're climbing out of ideas into time. Mm-hmm. Let's remember that. So you're not just climbing into time, you're climbing out of something into time. Mm-hmm. And what are you climbing out of? Ideas. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. AKA liberalism. Mm. I'd like it to be recorded that that is an expanded version of what we mean when we use the word liberalism. Mm-hmm. It's not just politics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It's ideas.
In a sense, it's ideas, yeah.
Well, and
it's a certain type of ideas, but yeah, go ahead.
You've had like a very close experience with death, or facing death, with cancer.
Yes.
So I do think of you as having a more developed relationship with it than myself, for example.
Maybe yes.
Or then.
Maybe yes. I mean, I would want to put that in a way that doesn't make it sound like I have special knowledge, but I would say it's almost a question of like, I don't know. Have you ever put your bare hand into a burning fire? Well, if you do, you now have a sense of what it feels like to burn, right? And some people don't have that. Mm-hmm. Some people do have that. Have you ever smelled a dead body? Some people have, some people haven't. Have you ever, fallen? Mm-hmm. A story. I had a friend, he fell off the second story of our house in college. Really messed up his leg. Not a fatal fall, but he had the experience mm-hmm. of falling and surviving. A lot of people who fall don't survive. They fall off the edge of the Grand Canyon. They fall off the Empire State Building, whatever. But he had the experience of falling. So,
people
yes, I
fall off the Empire State Building. Huh?
Sorry, jump.
Oh, Jesus.
People jump off the Empire State Building. What?
I didn't know that.
You didn't know that?
No.
Oh, yeah. There's a famous photo of a woman. She landed on a car. Ugh.
What? That's terrible.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry yeah, I brought
yeah.
it up.
No, sorry.
I know you hate all things like that. Mm. I have a certain thing. I guess you're right. I've stood a little closer to death maybe than, but in a sense I haven't.
Yeah.
Also.
Yeah.
I think that's important to remember. Yeah.
But do you need to understand? I guess not really.
You know, but it's like, the many ways in which you can't even count the ways in which we come to understand death. And there are ways in which you've come to understand death that I've recoiled from fundamentally, you know? Yeah. So you understand death in your own way and lots of different ways that I haven't even started to understand it. Because every Dasein is unique. Mm-hmm. And everybody's living a unique time and a unique appropriation. Mm-hmm. And some people are like super face death all the time because they just have death. They have a you know, death is just present in their perspective. Mm. You know? I don't know. I brought up death. I brought up sitting in the driveway. I thought about thinking about the landscape and climbing into time, just as I try to make a parse and a little bit of an interpretation of this concept of time that he's giving us and how we can live with it, not just know it at our death. Yeah. But I think that the death is important because this definition of time is a very Heideggerian thing, but death is actually very important to Heideggerianism and existentialism in general. Why is existentialism always talking about death? Why is death a central theme in existentialism and in Heidegger? Because Heidegger spends a lot of time in Being and Time talking about how death is the ultimate horizon of Dasein. Mm. Well, because death is always there, and in every that's the clearing, concealing. Mm. That's the appropriation. That's the last God. That's the event. Mm. The event, which is the truth of Bang, comes and goes, is born and dies. Theater is openings and closings. That's as my good friend said, you know, that's so the death is always there. Mm. And the more you realize the death is there, the more you can start to climb into time and be appropriated by Bang and actually live while you're alive. Mm. Because I don't really want to say you don't live if you are wrapped up in ideas, but you definitely are not experiencing primordial temporality, as Heidegger defines it. Mm-hmm. You're not experiencing events. You're not experiencing historical recollection. You're not experiencing Bang. You're not experiencing the truth of Bang. You're living with being abandoned by being, and you're missing out. Mm-hmm. I think that's at the heart of the book. Mm-hmm. And I think the least that can be said for that is that it is a valuation. It is a surmisal. It is a normative statement. But I think Heidegger is trying to push it to the level of experiential, if not a meditative, if not experiential fact. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So yeah, great. That's it.
Yeah.
Time to have a little drink.
Yes.
Good night.
Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Choya podcast. For more information, visit leapingchoya.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.